beyond Novak? Is that in question? Isn't the question the motive, the seriousness of it? Is that in question? I mean,
yes, I think it is, because the reporters haven't even. We don't know the six other reporters.
But you don't need to know the six other
reporters. No, but two of them have gone and said, but two of them have spoken
up. I think what gives this story its certainty in Washington, at least, is that whatever I think of his opinions or his personality, Novak is a professional. He's done this for half a century. He's not going to confuse what the term senior administration official means. He's not going to make it up. So the fact, his original column really says it all.
And so you don't believe the back pedal?
On 30 levels, no.
Okay. This is actually where it's helpful to be surrounded by Washington journalists, perhaps. Though last week, weren't they all saying it was Carl Rove, and now this week they're all saying
they never said it was Carl Rove.
That was
just a quick thing.
Yes, sir.
I'm just stepping back a bit. It's really interesting. These are people who we read individually, and now we're seeing them actually in conversation. There is the step back and compare and contrast what you're doing now to what you do online. Because this is a blogger conference. So you've given us a great example now to talk around.
Now, I've got a question. I want to try this out. Are you a publication, Glenn, or are we all a publication?
I think the blogosphere is a distributed intelligence.
That's what
and,
I mean.
You know, one of the things I do, and I did this during the war, I tried to sort of blog the war news in Afghanistan, and by the Iraq war, I was just too mentally exhausted to do that again. And so I steered everybody to the command post, which did a better job than me anyway. And that's, to some degree, what I've done with the Plain Wilson thing. I mean, I've written about the stuff that I have opinions on, like they should subpoena the damn journalists to get to the truth and fire whoever's responsible or throw them in jail. That's my take on
right.
it. And the journalists don't like that because, in fact, it's in the interest of journalists to keep the scandal going as long as possible and to not have to take responsibility for
public.
It's
the interest of journalists to protect our first institution.
That too.
The New York Times is a paper, the National Enquirer is a paper. Where does that line stop? Does this not be you?
Well, I don't know. I guess if I felt like the New York Times would stand behind me if I were subpoenaed, I'd feel better about it. I'd be surprised if they did. But at any rate, I think the blogosphere is a distributed intelligence, and I think that
you also said something by not writing about it.
That was my point.
I didn't write about it.
Well,
I did.
I'm
go
sorry,
to my site and
you minimized
it. But you're not writing about it right now.
So the difference is that
I can't get on the damn wireless network.
The difference is that other bloggers were jumping all over it, and Josh was you know posting every minute about it, and posting great stuff, and you know and you were sort of posting a little bit about
and
it. And
there's
data
there.
That's why I actually disagree with Ed, and I think you know what Glenn did there is totally fine. If this story really is a huge story, as some of us think it is, and if it has legs, and if it takes some you know important administration officials down with it, as I hope it does, you know, at some point, Glenn, who has a lot of authority as a blogger, and I think well-earned, will lose some portion of that. And he may win it back again.
Right.
Josh has gained a lot of authority, I think, from his coverage of it, because he's done such a great job.
How about Trump
That's the way
not
it works.
Losing? Maybe he will gain a bit of definition. In other words, we will know something new about Glenn that we didn't know before. Net positive, not negative.
Well, but I think of Glenn as being more than Fox News. I mean, here's an important
thing.
Here's a very important thing to me. I don't know that we disagree about this at all, Scott. I mean, Glenn has all of us. Each of us has the right to put on our weblog what we want to put on our weblog. That's part of the reason we do it. I'm not talking, and this is a conversation I have with my 12-year-old a lot of the time. I'm not talking about what you can do. I'm talking about what you ought to do. And my question is, as a personal ethical, as a man, or a woman, I'm sorry, but if you call people who question the success of a war and weapons of mass destruction traitors, and here is a...
I don't think I've done that. No, I think that's quite
unfair. Is anybody's connection working?
And I think I've.
I'm sorry. The fifth column means traitor.
And I think there are people. I mean, I would call somebody like Noam Chomsky in that category. But I was very careful during the war debate to talk to people like Jim Henley, who were anti-war, but who I felt actually wanted us to win. And this goes to James Lilac's point. You have to hope we win. You can argue about other stuff.
Right.
If you hope we lose, and people do, and I've quoted people like Chrissy Hines saying, give us what we deserve, we deserve.
Chrissy,
that's what I'm talking about.
I mean, but wait a minute. I'm sorry. Hold on. I just want to say, you said in at least one post that I linked to on Wednesday, you indiscriminately said fifth columnists are prevalent in the media, and without naming names. So to me, you have, and this is personal.
I'm quoting Andrew Sullivan, but okay.
But no, I want to finish. I just want to. This is the power of that Glenn Reynolds has over me. I read Instapundit every day because I respect the hell out of the guy's mind. I'm very interested in what you say. And now here's something. I'm sorry. Here's something that reflects directly on what you've been saying. And it's, do you owe me? Do you owe your audience that answer? I don't know if there's a.
I think I owe you an honest opinion. I don't owe you to have the opinion you apparently want me to have.
No, I don't
and
have
I think that.
No, that's not it. That's not it at all. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I have a meta comment, and that is that I'm really looking forward to hearing more about journalism and wedlock and interesting questions about that. I happen to be on Ed's side in the claim affair rather than Glenn's side, but I'm really one of the things that I think is super interesting about blogs and journalism is that blogs not only have the power to break stories, but also power to, some little power, to say what stories are important and what stories are interesting, what stories won't be forgotten. I mean, to get away from the claim, okay, the whole thing about the AstroTurf letters to the editor, that completely was not in the big newspapers, and in fact, it never made it very far from the until the weblog.
I think the weblog breaking a story or pushing a story is also limited. Josh, you tried like hell to get that Texas redistricting thing to catch fire. You covered it, and
it caught fire.
Not a raging inferno, shall we say? There are limits, and yes. one of the big phony things about weblogs in the media is that it's either or. To me, the interesting thing is how the weblog frequently feeds the media. And pushes a story forward, and then it becomes a real story when the big media gets it and breaks it. Do you ever feel frustrated, you guys, that there's a story you're banging on and it doesn't? I mean, this is a guy, by the way, who doesn't just get invited to go on Paula Zahn this week. He turns her down. do you ever feel, though, that nobody's buying what you're selling?
Yeah, I mean, most of my blogging tends to be either stuff that really interests me or stories that I think aren't getting the attention they deserve. And, you know, you blog on stuff, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Trent Lott, it worked. Other stuff, it doesn't. And that's the breaks. I sort of feel like if it's a story everybody's talking about, I need to have something to add to it, not just say that it's there.
Sorry.
Let people talk.
I really don't care about your story. Specific story, I care a lot more about the process and the mechanism, and I especially take offense at the idea that you think the Board of State has a law.
Who's you?
I'm sorry, me? I'm Phil Wolf. All of them basically said, if you're a blogger, you're not a professional, you don't have the coverage of the I have to reveal my sources and all that kind of stuff. As a journalist, why do you have, as a professional journalist getting paid for it, why do you have protections that I know I'm not getting paid for?
I don't think professional journalists do or should. Their protections are political, which is that, and Howard Kurtz wrote about this last week. Eugene Volokh points out that reporters really don't have a First Amendment right not to reveal their sources despite claims otherwise. And Howard Kurtz says, yeah, but it'd be a PR disaster for the White House to go after. Well, that's probably true, but that's really the extent of protection.
Well, you do have a variety of shield laws.
There are state laws that only work at the federal level.
But they work at the state level if you're in a state.
If the state tries to get the information,
we
sure.
That the bloggers as a community should have the protection of those shield laws. And if not, what should we do about it?
Well,
go ahead.
All right. My question is to take this away from you as journalists and look at your audience. My field is education. I spent a lot of years as a high school science teacher. And it's in print. The kids believe it's fact. So if you talk about how you get some source that may or may not be believable, but it's going to put it in your blog, and so it might having somebody's opinion that's masquerading as some fact. And that you start to go, you know, there are huge long websites of urban myths that kids believe.
You're never going to be able to enforce an internet-wide standard. It's just simply not possible. You'd have to radically alter the internet. So the answer to me lies not in trying to promulgate some kind of standard of accuracy, but rather continuing, as I'm sure every teacher does, to educate people that, in fact, everything that they see in print is not true. And one of the most valuable things about weblogs, I think, is that in practice, of doing the work that many webloggers do, you see the process of someone taking a story, whether it's Wes Clark saying Karl Rove didn't call me, so Karl Rove had called me, I had been a Republican, which Josh kind of showed how it was a rumor that was spread by, was a rumor that was spread by some...
An interested party's third-hand account, then sort of recycled into an actual
statement
and then debunked.
It wasn't, exactly. that, in fact, when you read that, you start thinking very differently about everything you read. And that is the process that blogs accelerate in everyone who reads them, and that is the process that people can then in turn turn not only on what they're reading on the internet, which they desperately need to do, but also onto what they read everywhere. And that's great.
I think that we've seen, and we've all talked quite a bit on our weblogs about the idea that there's a process of disintermediation, or blogs are disruptive technology, where whether it's Gawker or it's Instapundit or Josh, we have an alternative form of journalism emerging that's separate from the institution. And we've talked about that a lot. I'd like to sort of flip the conversation and see what you guys think about how institutions should be approaching the blogging form. We know that there's a whole cadre now of really smart people who are writing independently or becoming powerful voices. We're also seeing that institutions continue on the whole to either shut down bloggers or really have them as adjuncts to their primary print columns. And I'd love to hear you guys talk with your media hats on about the institutional forms of journalism and how do you think they should be working either with established bloggers or integrating some of the benefits of blogging into their structures to meet the obvious demand and interest in authenticity that a lot of blogging offers.
I thought the BBC's war blog was quite good, except for the fact that it lacked permalinks, which was infuriating. But, leaving that aside, I thought it was really good. I thought Kevin Seitz's blog that CNN shut down was terrific. And I just don't get this. They could have made so much out of free content. I mean, basically, it's like having somebody saying, I'd like to stay at the office a few extra hours and make money for you and not get paid, and having you tell them, no! I'm just mystified. I guess if CNN's having problems, I guess that illustrates why, because all they needed to have was a little box on their page. Kevin Seitz's blog from Iraq. Go see it. It's branded.
We're going to have a session about just this subject with experts. These guys are...
We're not experts. Don't
not on that subject, but they will get a chance to tell those guys how to do it. I'd like them to stay focused.
Can I just play
of course.
The journalism question? It goes back to Josh's interview with Wesley Clark. I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit for that, Josh. To me, that was a tremendous and totally bloggish breakthrough. That interview could not have appeared on television, on cable, or in the New York Times, or any place else that I can imagine. And the virtue of it really was, it was long. It went from the moment he got in the car at the airport until he got out of the Capitol. It was like an autobiography, except it was spoken. It was his whole top of the heap, the top of his head on his experience, policy views. I thought it was unbelievably rich. I mean, really, it was a revelation. This is a new journalism. Much as Hunter Thompson was a new journalism. I love the idea that there is no journalism. It's always evolving. There are no rules. And this was a breakthrough.
Thank you.
But my question is, how would institutional journalism or public journalism replicate that with another candidate, with another moment? Among other things, I thought, this is unfair because very few people have the sort of available intellect that Wesley Clark brought to that thing. He was candid. He was talking to you straight. If the New York Times had done they announced we'll do a full-page interview with every candidate, it would not have had the candor, the immediacy, the directness that he had. So in other words, I thought there was a real jewel there, revealed. This is what you can do if an intelligent, experienced candidate decides to talk straight to a human being in a car, and we've got it all on record. Without any editing, you didn't put a lead on it. How do we do that again is the question.
I mean, just a couple of things that were in my mind when I did that, and that interview was fairly similar to, I did an interview with Joe Wilson about 3 weeks earlier, two things. One is that I approach those, and the questions that I ask are very much what I'm interested in. And obviously, if I were working for a larger institution, there would be pressure to ask more questions and stuff like that. The other thing is that I, and some of the people who've been critical of that interview, is that I wasn't, jumping in and focusing the questions and stuff like that. And partly that's because my interest is, any candidate can give you a minute's worth or 2 minutes of like chatter. They've got that down. And so just my interest is much more, can they really talk at length? And when they're talking at length, stuff's gonna, you can't stay on message in the same way when you're talking at length. Obviously what I was relying on there is my kind of arrangement with my readers is kind of like, here it is, if it's too long, don't read it. I just don't feel that pressure.
You don't have to make room for the car ads.
My little donation is. But I mean, the point is that there's, it's not a take it or leave it, but, I think that people who read the site are willing to read longer stuff. And so I just.
Could you do it again with another candidate? Could you do it with John Kerry?
Maybe I should comment on that. I think so.
Let me ask one question. I know we have a question in the back. How much time do we have left?
You have about 25 minutes.
Oh, hell, okay. Mr. Willis.
I was going to say, I think one of the problems we're running into right now is that we're heading into the Fox Newsification of blogs, which is basically guys that are saying that, fair and balanced, but you're not coming up front with your biases, whether they're left or right or, whatever. Just say what your biases are. I mean, I tend to do that on my side. I go, I'm a liberal, I support the Democrats, I love Bill Clinton. But there's a lot of sides out there, especially, they say they're libertarian, whatever, that essentially are saying, well, I follow down the line, but truth be told, if you look at what your links are in your commentary, it's going to be slanted one way or the other. So I think it's the same thing with the news organizations, where they're saying, we call it down the line, but, they're not, even whether it's one way left or right. You have the same thing happening with Fox. We're basically doing the worst of what they're doing as well. So even though it's the news...
We're going to let Lance go next.
I think on that... It's a very American perspective that people need to declare their biases. If you lived in almost any other country, the culture of reading media or reading a paper is you come to understand, and readers are expected to understand, that the Daily Telegraph comes to a story with a particular view, the Guardian comes with a different view, the Independent another one, the Financial Times another one, and they assume their readers have the intelligence and discernment to understand their biases. They don't pose behind the notion that, of course, we're absolutely objective because they understand there is no objectivity. I think this idea that people should have to declare their biases is talking down to the readers.
But Lance, I think what all we're saying is people are putting a smokescreen or a curtain in front of their biases and saying, it's not so much saying they have to declare, it's like, quit saying that those aren't your biases. I mean, there's a dishonesty.
I want to make sure we have enough time to talk about the vision, okay? So we kind of talked about where we're at, but what's the future? What are you guys going to be doing a year from now, 2 years? Glenn, is your blog going to exist a year from now, 2 years?
I have no idea. I've said for a long time ago that I'd do it as long as it was fun.
But what do you want to do that you're not doing? And this is for all of you guys. What's the vision for the kind of blogging that you do?
I have no more business plan than I had when I started. I mean, I really do things pretty much day to day, and I like it. If it quits being fun, I'll stop. And I have to tell you, the thing about it, people always ask me how I write so much. And the writing part is easy. The part that has become more tiring as time's gone, and part of that's because of the times we've been in, is you have to pay attention to the news. And there are all these psychological studies that show that the more attention you pay to the news, the more depressed and angry, irritable and overweight you tend to be. And I've been paying more attention to the news the last couple of years than I ever did before, and I was a news junkie before. And I have to say, there are times when, you know, I start to look at the newspaper or I start to turn on NPR or CNN or something, and I just sometimes just don't want to think about it. I think about how, you know, when I first started blogging, one of the things I blogged on was the poll from the Boston Globe on who had the best ads at the Video Music Awards. And, you know, that kind of stuff, I was making fun of it then, but now I look back on it and I say, that was kind of nice. There's no war, there's no death, there's no disease. I mean, it was kind of, I missed that.
There's a common set of comments that everybody's made that I don't know if the social collective has really understood, and that's we all tend to edit our own opinion of each other. It's I read each one of your sites on a semi-regular basis, but I place no more credit or credence on any one opinion that you have unless I can validate that against my own level of believability. If I read in 15 different places that I evaluate as reputable that Glenn's opinion or Glenn's statement of fact matches those other 15 sites, I will tend to believe what he says is fact. And there was an educator in the back that mentioned students who read science books believe students who believe statements whatever's written there is fact. And it's a custom that I've grown to is whatever's written is something that I should evaluate and I should educate myself about. And I think that's something that people have done with traditional media, but after a time they handed over to traditional media the back checking, the fact checking, the I'll trust that the guy brought in the right kind of source. And what weblogs have done differently is that they've allowed you to do your own fact checking, to do your own fact checking, and you begin to get not only different opinions, but different restatements of the same fact. And I think that's the thing, what I'm trying to say here is I think that's a thing that we're all doing. We've done it with traditional media before, but we're doing it with weblogs now, but we're using different words to describe it.
I want to follow on the future question, though. One of the nicest things about the end of the 90s is that I won't phrase this question to each of you guys by saying, how do you plan to monetize those eyeballs? But if it was the 90s, I would phrase it that way. I mean, look, we'd all like to get paid to do our dream jobs. We'd all like to turn our weblogs into, well, I say we all would. I would love to do nothing but blog all day and get paid tons of money for it. I don't have a plan for that, but I have a dream for that. You guys, where are you going to be? Are you going to still be? I mean, look at you, Josh. You're getting cited by Paul Krugman as the guy he reads. What happens when the New York Times comes to you and says, we're going to make you a political writer, but you have to quit your weblog? Glenn Hathcourt said something to me in the hallway.
Yeah. They ought to give him a blog, is what they ought to do.
Well, right. I mean, I've actually, had that happen with, significantly less prestigious publications than the New York Times. But publications that I like a lot, good publications. And I just haven't even considered that for a lot of reasons. Frankly, it's very difficult for me to imagine any circumstance that or any sort of job opportunity that I would give up doing the blog just for a lot of reasons.
Can you imagine taking the blog and putting it under the logo of a big media something?
No.
Why?
Because then I would basically just because I'd have to run things by them. And
but you're sitting next to a guy who puts the logo on top of his blog. Scott, does that bother? Does that?
Yeah, but you started it that way.
Salon started as a rebellion against a newspaper. We were a bunch of people at the San Francisco Examiner who were very unhappy after a strike and who left to start a website. So we're coming from a very different place. I don't know what I'm hearing from the world of traditional newspapering. Is that the sort of Dan Gilmore case is more the exception than the rule. I was reading in this Nieman Reports thing that just came out with all this stuff about blogging, an editor for a newspaper, I think it was the Hartford Courant, but correct me if I'm forgetting, his editor explaining why he had told this staffer who had been moved to the travel section and who started his own personal blog that the guy had to shut the blog down. And he was entirely, you know, he did not see what the problem was. This was the right decision. He'd do it again, and that's that. So, you know, I don't see that, you know, that's going to change so quickly. But can I circle back to the sort of future question also? You know, my hope for the future is that in a year or 2 years, we're no longer asking this question, you know, how are weblogs going to make money or how are they going to fit into, you know, business? Because I think that, you know, I've spent the last 8 years trying to, and still basically failing, to turn a web a magazine into a successful business. We're still not making money. My view of the prospects for weblogs and making money is don't even try. You know, Dave, you posted something yesterday or the day before that, you know, maybe this is just a matter of people telling stories to each other, you know, and that's okay. And I think that's what this is all about. It's not big business, and it's not the business of journalism. That's what makes it special. That's what makes it worth having a conference to talk about.
Another question that relates to a thread that's kind of running through all of us, I think. I formerly worked as a newspaper editor. I know as a newspaper editor, something that kind of guided all of my thinking all the time was thinking about who are my audience, who's my readers. Now I blog, and I have no idea most of the time who my audience is, who are my readers. I wonder if you are giving any thought to who your readers are, and if you are, what have you decided about who they are?
I want to hit on that, and I'll jump in because it goes to another really interesting thing that I don't know we're going to have time to do, and that is the idea of the local weblog. I mean, everybody's writing around the world, and we're here from everywhere, but when I think of my audience, a lot of times, there's something we were talking last night, Rush Limbaugh. I don't even care what I think of Rush Limbaugh, right? I mean, you know, I mean, because we all have the same feeling, and that's going to get covered. But in Greensboro, North Carolina, there are hot political issues that aren't getting covered, and certainly not getting blogged. So I started writing more and more for a local audience, and what I found was, all of a sudden, we've got a half dozen local blogs in Greensboro covering local politics. So you're, and I still have a national audience of dozens on several days, and I try to write for them too and make it interesting for them. But yeah, I target my stuff to I think journalists, political readers, and a local audience, and that I'm very conscious of writing for that audience, and I don't swear as much now that I write for a local audience. So
yeah, I know in Knoxville, S.K. Bubba, who's one you know you may know, has really taken up the local blogging thing, and he's quite rapidly become a factor in local politics.
Absolutely.
Because we have one monopoly newspaper, which is not a bad newspaper, but it's one monopoly newspaper. We have one alt-weekly, which is a good alt-weekly, but it's one alt-weekly, and there's just a lot of this stuff doesn't get covered, and there are a lot of advertisers that people would probably rather not offend, and they're just, you know, there's only so much time. It takes a lot of time to do stories and things, and he's made a difference. I think it's a huge market opportunity because there's millions of people writing about stuff happening in the world.
Right, Jarvis does it too, but there's a question behind him. Sorry.
Just jumping back several points, I feel like, you know, a bunch of people used to writing monologues trying to have a dialogue.
And Jeff wanted to say something about the that and the local thing together, I think.
Exactly. I know my audience better than I ever did writing for huge magazines because it's now down to an intimacy. When you get to local, it gets to be extremely intimate. And it's not just about uncovering issues or non-monopoly views, put it bluntly. It's also about more information. It's simply that. Journalism going forward cannot afford big institutions to cover every meeting and bring out every piece of bit of fact, and bloggers will bring out more information. Take the weight away from her, take the baggage away, and that's going to be great, and that's going to serve more people you know, your neighbors.
And bloggers will also bring out more bloggers. I mean, the old joke is that in a town with one lawyer, the lawyer goes broke, and then you have two lawyers, they both get rich. And I'm finding that. I mean, we have, in Greensboro, we have people covering, and they get pissed off at what I write or what each other, and they start their own weblogs. And that's something I learned from Dave, is that weblogs and links breed more weblogs and links.
Can I just say one thing? So, yes. You know, newspaper editors spend a lot of time sitting around saying, you know, who is our audience? How can we find out who our audience is? And they take surveys, and they spend a lot of money. When you're online, you know who your audience is because they're talking back to you. At the Examiner, where I worked for 9 years, I remember in 1993 or so, I wanted to put my email address on the end of my column. And an editor who shall remain nameless, but he now runs a major newspaper in San Francisco, and said, you know, we can't publish our email addresses. And I said, why not? He said, if we start publishing email addresses, we'll have to answer the email.
My name is Randall Perry, and I'm a lawyer and a journalist. And I just wanted to go back to the point raised by the gentleman sitting to my left over here. Concerning whether bloggers should have, you know, protection of sources and so on.
Right.
If in fact bloggers are writing something for public consumption, which they obviously are, they are publishers and therefore subject to libel law. Should they not then? I'm asking you to comment. Should they not then have protections if in fact what they are publishing can be deemed news? Maybe that's the core question. Should they then be have the protections, you know, as far as sources? I just want to add one point when about the CIA case and all that. As I understand it, the statute from was passed in the early 80s, pushed by the Reagan administration and the senior George Bush to punish people who leak CIA agents under, you know, undercover agents' identities. That same law, there was a lot of discussion about carving out an exception and protecting journalists. And so that is a matter. They can't punish them.
They can subpoena them, and that's different. I mean, I certainly think
that... Why are you so big on going after the journalists when they can just... We know who the people are in the White House.
Well, I guess that's the part I don't see. I'm happy... You can depose anybody, and you can fire whoever did it. I view the underlying crime as quite serious, and I'm perfectly happy. I mean, if Dick Cheney did it, you can fire Dick Cheney, and that's fine with me.
Yep.
You know, and I've never said otherwise, which is why I find people's reactions to my postings a bit odd. But
did everyone take down that bit about Dick Cheney?
We have a question.
It's on my blog. Of course, you can't read it.
We have a comment in the back.
Did you answer the question?
I'm sorry. Did I not answer the question?
I think all I think weblogs that practice journalism should have the same protections offered by the Constitution to other journalists. That's what I think, and I'm not a lawyer. I just play one on TV.
But
and
those are less than most people think, however.
Right.
Yeah.
And
the protection for journalists is a subject of constant tension and change. The law is always changing in these areas, and the internet, as a larger subject, the law around the internet itself is still, you know, hugely undecided and is, you know, in flux. So the whole fight and blogging, you know, which is even newer than the internet, is it's going to take some time. The lawyers and the courts move much more slowly on these things than we are used to moving in blog life.
Yep, we have a question.
What do you guys think about the role of commenters on your site? Was there any decision to put comments in or not? And does the scroll factor ever make you think, my God, take my comments out?
Well, Gwen can't handle comments.
I can't handle comments. I've done it. I've opened a few threads to comments, and it's become a troll fest for me. And there are blogs, and I try not to disrespect other blogs, by name especially, but there are blogs that have a lot of comments that are often troll-fest that I am much less inclined to link to or even to read because, frankly, I find the comment section very off-putting. I mean, Charles Johnson's Little Green Footballs blog is one of those. I find I don't go there very often, and I link there less often because you link to an interesting post that may be inoffensive, but there's all kinds of stuff in the comments that I just don't care to link to. And on my own site, I just... I think there's a critical traffic level beyond which comments don't work very well. They turn into Usenet or a chat board. I have, by accident, left a couple of threads open, and I go back and have to delete sex stuff and spam and stuff. So I'm not willing to put the time into policing comments.
Josh, you don't run
comments.
I'd like
to say something about comments here that really, the insight, if you've ever been there, comments work incredibly well, okay? And they get more comments than anybody. So if you have a community that says, we are a community, and we care about something, 500,000 people have actually signed up, said they're a community, that's very important. So I disagree with Dave's comment earlier. That the Dean campaign is only a start. Well, in fact, the Dean campaign blog is the comments. That's the thread that matters. If any of you visited there, it's incredible. So they're doing it. Why it works there and nowhere else
is. Comments is also one of the areas that the technology needs to improve.
Right.
You know,
well, there's a fundamental law of comments that goes like this.
It's hard to
in the first week that you're running it, you don't get flames. And, or first, and like Ed Cohn's site, when the comments show up there, he doesn't get flames.
I don't mind flames, by the way. But if I put comments on scripting news,
and I know this because I did used to have it, it would be 100% flames. There would be nothing but flames.
As in physics.
It's a matter of time.
As in physics, laws last until they're disproven.
Right.
And if you go to the Dean campaign and watch 400 people.
No, they haven't been doing it long enough. As soon as there will come a point. The low roaders haven't found them yet.
Well, when Rush Limbaugh mentions the Dean campaign comments, you'll have a different experience.
The comment about audiences and comments, you know, we talk a lot about who our audience is and how our audience now is web bloggers is different than in the newspapers. And, you know, do our audience, are they expecting something different from bloggers than they are expecting from newspapers? And does that affect how we should talk to them and how we are talking? And in regards to comments, would you rather have someone comment on your site or start a new blog and have their own opinion?
Start a new blog.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both.
I think what people are expecting of a blog is the authenticity of an individual voice. And to the extent that they can identify that when they're reading the blog, they're going to respond. To the extent that they don't sense that, they're going to be disappointed. And then where that gets interesting is where you have people feeling betrayed. People who feel that they thought that this was authentic or that this was real, and then they discover that it's not what they thought it was, whether it's because they stumbled upon a blog that was a marketing ploy, or I'm thinking of during the war, we had a situation of a blog called The Agonist, which a lot of people were following for its coverage of the war, and it turned out that he was cribbing some of his posts from another site, and it all got, you know, I don't even remember what the upshot of it was, but there was a sense of disappointment among his readership that, you know, it wasn't quite what it seemed to be.
Okay, I know we're going to have to wrap this thing up, so yes.
So, the key underlying question here is who gets to speak when? Question here. With Weblog, everyone can speak in parallel, and the truth can emerge over time. With a classic democracy, most of the rules are down to who can speak, who can introduce topics, who can start discussions, because there is a single channel going on at once. There is one debating forum. And the interesting thing about comments is it plays into sort of old game theory results. There's the prisoner's dilemma thing where if you have a one-shot event, everyone betrays. They don't do the trustworthy thing. But if you have repeated interactions over time, have what's called an iterated prisoner's dilemma, then the fact that I have to interact with that person again makes them behave a lot better. And because with a blog you have an identity, you have a history and a future, you're more careful about what you say there than if you go posting someone's comments and you can text something, hit and run and go away. So part of the thing that blogging provides is that shadow of the future from the iterated prisoner's dilemma. So there's two pieces to that. One is that thing which improves quality of stuff. It's why comments today when they're not trusted. But the second thing, which I think is even more important, is the serial parallel thing. There isn't just one agenda, there are many agendas. There is a lot going on at once. And we can each pick out the bits we're interested in. We're much less worried about it being a paper record than we have a million pages of record.
And I try not to flame much on my blog, by the way, which is probably one reason I don't get a lot of flames. Back when I get a flame or a troll, I just think that is somebody who doesn't have a lot to do with their time, and I don't really respond to it. Chris?
I'm Jay Rosen from New York University. Hi. What I look at blogs, what seems to me radical about them, is about four different things, but I want to talk about one of them. First of all, they take place in the gift economy. That's radical from the point of view of the journalism that we've had. Almost zero barrier to entry. That's extremely radical. But the thing that is the most radical from my point of view is that the audience, as we've known it, does not exist anymore. It's the audience for web bloggers increasingly is just not these people that we've imagined on the other end of journalism for so long, sitting there receiving your opinion, receiving your information, and saying, that's interesting, or I agree, or I don't agree. Readers, and people that we've called readers for almost 500 years, are now writers. That is the radical. When I have a small comment section, there's not many things in there, which is okay. But I got this very strange sensation when every time that I would click on the person who wrote a comment on my site, it's a website, it's a blog. And that's not a reader, that's a writer. And I don't think we know yet what journalism is under conditions where every reader is a writer.
Right.
That's what's strange.
Maybe it's all backstage.
Tell them who you are. Just
I'm chair of the journalism department at NYU. I'm a writer, and I'm trying to make sense of the world.
I just wanted to second what you said about audiences, and I don't feel like I have an audience when I blog. In fact, I think I'm Doc Searles. When I'm on stage and I'm giving a talk, that's an audience, okay, that I'm talking to out there. But I don't have a sense of an audience. The term audience doesn't even belong in this conversation. And the reader's right. That is a relationship there. It goes beyond conversations very often.
I want to, and look, by the way, they let Doc hold the mic. That's clout. I want to say one thing about our host here, and not to kiss up to him, but of the two great things that Dave did for me, and this is pertinent to the journalism part, one is the spicy noodles he turned me on to, and those were great. But also, to me, Dave Weiner's great insight is a phrase, the web is a writer's medium. And when he told me that in 2000 or 99, I thought the web was porn, whatever, you know, stocks, whatever the web was then. And the web is a writer's medium, is what I'm hearing people say, but that has huge implications for journalists. Everybody's a journalist, and that goes to the legal questions too. So that's what I think, that's why he's running the panel, because he figured that out early and put it into words.
We have to wrap this up, let's have this be the last, okay?
So just to follow up on the last couple of comments, I'm Tim Jarrett, I'm with Microsoft, but I don't blog for them. I think that this closes full circle on the question that we opened with, which is there are bloggers who are in newspapers, but you don't get the institution, you know, speaking through them necessarily. I'm finding the beauty watching everything that's going on, it's happening with folks from Microsoft that blog too, is, you know, as long as you have people inside the organization blogging and you're connecting, you know, not only are your readers no longer an audience, they're individuals. The people in that institution kind of become individuals as well, and that's when you can actually start to triangulate, maybe not what the official policy is going to be that's going to come out from the New York Times on something, or, you know, from Microsoft on something, but more, you know, kind of what the people inside are actually thinking and what's important to them, and, you know, kind of where things might move in the future, and I think that's incredibly valuable.
I think we're going to wrap it up. I think this is really going to be, this whole day is going to be the ultimate Rashomon experience, where we're going to see how several dozen people have felt this particular elephant when we get back to our hotel rooms tonight. And I'd like to thank Josh and Scott and Glenn and all of you, because there is no audience, we're all doing it together, for a great conversation. And everybody go deep. Thank you.
I'm letting Glenn in.
We got another 15 minutes, then we get a break, okay? 15 minutes, then we got a break. 15 minutes, then we got a break. So is everybody... That's... Hello? Everybody, please, 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 please. Okay, we've got 15 minutes and then a half-hour break and a lot of options about how we use the time between now and the education panel, which is the next panel. You'll note on the schedule it says we're going to do interview with the blogger, and it doesn't say who we're doing the interview with. So I kind of wanted to leave those things open so that we could see how the conversation went, see what topics got exposed and where what people have an interest in. And so I sort of thought that maybe I would ask Dan Gilmore, who's not in his seat, I don't know where Dan went, and Doc Searles to come up after I just have some few comments myself to talk about the idea of an embedded blogger inside of a media organization. Because Dan, and I don't know if, well, we can't do this if he isn't, there he is, Dan. I thought, I'll just repeat what I said. We have a 15-minute slot now to do an interview with a blogger, and I thought, if you don't mind, that you and I and Doc, with sort of Doc in the middle, and each of us at one extreme, would talk about this idea of a blogger embedded in a media organization and what special responsibilities such a blogger might have. I think we're going to see a lot more of this. So are you up for doing that?
Yeah.
Okay, let me just talk for a few minutes. I want to talk about a few other things. And then, no, oh, yeah, all right. You know. First of all, I wanted to point out a few people in the audience. Matt Gross is over there. Would you wave your hand? He's the chief blogger for the Dean campaign. He'll be on the very last panel that we're doing today. But if you want to get a sort of preview on how that, you know, how that's been going, you can talk to him during a break or during lunch. Craig Klein, raise your hand in the back. Craig is my mentor and rabbi from Siebold. He's the editorial director at Siebold. I did the first bunch of these kinds of sessions with Craig. They were spectacularly successful and wouldn't have been so successful without him. I wanted to call out gratitude. My brother is in the room somewhere. Peter? Yeah, there he is. That's my kid brother, Peter Weiner, right there. And very honored to have him here today. We've been through a lot of stuff in the last year with sickness in the family and stuff, and this is like one of the very positive things we have. And Brian Bell, I think I saw Brian around. Brian probably designed your site. Brian is one of the first. I mean, if he didn't, certainly somebody who learned from Brian. Designed your site. He sort of pioneered the idea of site themes and templates, and lately has become an advocate of CSS and all the modern, what we call web standards, for what it's worth. I think they're mostly broken, and Brian knows that I feel that way, but I still respect him enormously. And if you want, you know, any advice on how your site could be better designed, you know, he's a great guy to talk to about that. So I want to ask a general question and do this really quickly if we can. How do y'all feel about how the last session went? Was that done well? Okay. And, you know, this idea of the guy with the microphone who holds on to it, and did we do all right with that? Right, yeah, I know.
If you could maybe have a chunk of time where the paneling.
Right. Well, let's put it this way. This is the way I feel about it, and this may sound a little harsh, is that I'm not overly concerned about people getting in, okay? What I'm concerned about is having a high-quality discussion where a lot of different angles get covered. One of my sort of frustrations with this is that I don't think they got enough time to talk. I wanted something specific out of this panel was to sort of establish for us, and I think that it worked in general, is to establish for us what journalism in the blogosphere is like, you know, and these guys are ultimate great practitioners of it. And I wanted to see what they would say if you put them together. That y'all played a role in that is obviously we wouldn't be bloggers if you didn't, right? So, but you know, it's kind of like, you know, somebody was raising the point that what's different about blogs from discussion groups and mail lists is that ultimately you do choose let somebody speak. And so that was their thing. So we'll just keep doing that for the next few sessions, okay? Right? We've got three more sessions today. However, I'm going to try to ask that question sort of at several times so that if there are some better ideas, let's improve the state of the art and how we do this.
Dave,
yeah?
But I think one issue is there's a kind of an issue of when the moderator's sitting
right.
The back is to the side of the room.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there was really a tremendous...
Right, there was a hole over here. Right. These guys didn't get a chance.
Yeah.
So what I told them, and I was aware of this issue, was I told them just stand up and talk, okay? In other words, if you have this thing that has to fit in the conversation right now and you know it and you're willing to, you know, take the chance that it's okay, well, you know, the worst that can happen is you look like an idiot, right, Jim? I mean, that
not a problem. And,
yeah, not a problem, right? I didn't think so. Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. Your comment was great, by the way. I thought it was really right on. At the moment it came, it was great. I know, nothing is perfect and nothing is perfectly fair. You know, I think we'll judge this based on whether or not we sort of had a good time or not, or whatever. So, I don't know. So, Dan and Doc, would you come up? And we're going to take about, let's see, we have to, one thing I committed to was we will be precise at the breaks and lunches. So we've got about 7 minutes to explore this issue. It's a heavy, heavy, heavy issue. And maybe all we'll succeed at doing is identifying it. See, I think the media industry is especially important that we get bloggers inside looking. And the reason why is that in 2003, the media industry and the political industry are one and the same. In other words, you look at the presidential campaigns and you measure their success or failure based on how much money they raise. Why do they have to raise so much money? So they can give it to the media industry so that they can run ads. So is there a conflict of interest potentially between a presidential candidate or a local candidate for that matter and the media industry? And the answer is, of course, there's a huge potential for it. Do we have any visibility into that connection? And the answer is no. So the question is, well, do we want, I mean, I have no doubt, I want bloggers inside the media industry to spend at least some portion of what they do self, you know, introspecting, looking at how this works. So Dan Gilmore, who I consider a friend for many years, was one of the pioneers of blogging, you know, in journalism. He started blogging in 1999, and as a result, walked into the middle of the firing line. I mean, he stood up and said, I'm at Knight Ridder, I'm at the San Jose Mercury News, and I'm a blogger. So this sort of made him, in my mind, you know, sort of fair game to ask this question of. The question is, what is your policy about this? I mean, where do you draw the line, and how do you deal with questions that may come up relating to the job you have?
It's not a single line. It's like any institution. I work for them. I do not think it is my role to expose to the world the workings of the organization I work for. I think the blogging part and the exposing to the world is more about making what I do more transparent as a journalist than about making my organization transparent. And I know you want me to basically tell all that I know, but no one who, and you yourself pointed out that you don't do that here.
No, I don't want you to tell all. But I want to understand what I'm being told, okay? In other words, if there's a line, I need, as a reader, if I'm to trust you, I need to understand where that line is. And the more concerned I am about that line, the issue that sort of raised this was when the Mercury News deleted all of Dan's archives, okay? And I had been pointing into the Mercury News archive as a matter of policy, considered them authoritative. And when something happened, I cover the technology industry. So when
John
I point, what?
What about John Robb? What happened there?
Okay, that's a fair question.
Page about you was deleted.
Pardon me?
An old page that was your bio page was deleted, removed.
Which page is that?
The one I used to point to. Probably still is broken.
Well, that's not an editorial decision, okay? Things break because they break, right? On the most, for the most part, I'll get to that question, okay? But for the most part, the archive for Scripting News is pretty good. It goes back to 1997. Every DaveNet that I've written is on the web. You know, most of the pages, yeah, but we're not, we weren't perfect. And our content management system had glitches, and we lost pages, or I forgot about them and spaced them out. With the matter of John Robb, it's a very delicate issue. And I would say the line, I have a line there, okay? I'm a member of the board of directors of that company and chief shareholder in the company. And I have a fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders of that company. I also am subject to the laws of the state of California and U.S. federal laws. And laws that pertain to employment are particularly one-sided in favor of the employee. That's really about what I can say about that. I mean, you know, I'm not allowed to tell certain pieces of information about that.
Then would that apply to employees who have employment agreements with, for example, publishing houses?
No, I've had no. I've always had things I can't write about, and I've been very straight about that. I think if I haven't been, I'd like to clear it up. But everybody has things they can't write about.
Indeed.
Right. I mean, that's not there. That's not in dispute by any stretch of the imagination. I guess I need to know, and I don't think we're going to figure this out now. Is what obligation, there's an industry out there, my point is there's an industry out there we have no visibility into because they are the industry that controls the flow of news. We don't see them, they're behind us, okay? But they're important.
You're talking about the media industry.
Correct.
I think there's more transparency into that than there's ever been before.
Really?
Where
do you get your information from?
I mean, if I'm reading Dan or I'm reading almost anybody who also writes for a newspaper or a media, it's not like they're busy disclosing everything they do in their day job all the time. But I have the sense that, for example, the Greensboro paper is more transparent because Ed's just out there talking about it. He'll take an editorial and he'll put it also in his blog because he put links in his blog where they're not. Correct me if I'm wrong about that, Ed. But that's the kind of thing that that some of the columnists will do. Now it may not be that the boiler rooms of decision making are fully exposed all the time, but I have a sense that they are so highly penetrated now by individuals who are also blogging and participating on the outside.
Do you think there are any big scandals, conflicts of interest between candidates and the media that we don't hear about?
I'm sure there are. I want to say with the Dean campaign, I'm looking forward to the point where the Dean campaign collects so much money and then decides not to spend any
money. That's what I'm waiting for. Or spend the money on the internet instead of taking it out of the internet and putting it into the damn media industry. I mean, those commercials, at some point, I don't know if they work. I kind of hope they don't. Somebody else? Dan Bricklin here.
Yeah.
Well, speak very loudly.
What you're saying is that if you're an insider, what's your responsibility as an insider? Because, I mean, a lot of us are outsiders commenting on what we see.
Well, the Clue Train Manifesto offers a clue about that, right? Okay? Basically, you're supposed to tell the truth. You know, and there's two sides to that.
You're supposed to talk.
But you're not supposed to lie when you talk, right,
well,
Doc?
I mean, or you will be exposed if you do lie. I mean, it's
right,
like,
you're
going to use your own voice.
But there's another side to it.
People will vacillate. People will equivocate. People will talk until they think of what to say. This is what people do.
Right.
Right? And they do it in their blogs, and they do it in...
But there's a second side to it, which is that people have to expect to be told what's going on, and they have to accept it when they actually are told what's going on.
Yeah. Dave, I think you have a view that the media have a particular obligation to be more transparent than other industries. And
no, I think the media industry doesn't achieve any transparency as compared to other industries.
And there is a reason that happens, and I'm more in agreement with you than you think. I think the media do a generally crappy job of covering the media, and that we need to do a lot more of that. But probably the good coverage is not going to be the New York Times blowing out two or four pages on Jason Blair, as opposed to the Washington Post going in and doing the story on Jason Blair and everyone else doing it. I think the media need to be more relentless with each other. I think we have to cover each other.
Or we
cover
as
other
bloggers industries. Have to be more relentless.
Well, fine.
So, Dan, would you be able to go after the New York Times? Would your editors let you do that?
You don't
work for the Washington Post.
If I had some kind of really terrific thing, sure, I hope. I don't see why they wouldn't. I don't.
But there's a lot of. You're not sure though.
Well, I think we've been as an institution, the large institution, we've been reluctant to take each other on.
I'd like to ask Jay Rosen. What do you think? Do you think that these guys are playing footsie under the table, or are they really being, you know, insightful and going go-getters and getting the story? Are they covering themselves, the media industry?
I think the opaque nature of news organizations is coming to an end, and that they are discovering that it's not only possible to be more open, but they have to be. If you read the Siegel report, which was the report in the Times internal committee examining what went wrong, it's a very interesting document, unjustly neglected, I think. And it's all about transparency. It says we need to be more transparent as an organization. We have to make our decision-making more transparent. And the most amazing thing to me is that it uses the word accountability about 10 times.
And how does that work? Will we be able to raise issues with the New York Times and expect
to... that particular institution, they're going to have an ombudsman who's going to take that to do development. Their columnist now, like Christoph, has a blog. That's a new development. They are much more in conversation with the culture. And the fact that the Times cannot ignore the way other news organizations, other journalists are talking about them is extremely significant. If you looked at Howell Raines' last few months, years, you'd find that in the beginning of his tenure, he never commented when somebody raised questions about Times News Judgment. And by the end,